All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm Bryce, joined by Pizza Mind, my absolutely incredible, notorious best friend. How's it going, man?
This is the new and improved Pizza Mind coming at you for the first time here on the Crypto 101 podcast. I'm going to be singing Kumbaya for the next 30 minutes here with you guys. No crazy rants, no wild predictions, no angry outbursts for at least this episode.
You swear?
No.
What's a Crypto 101 episode without a little crazy outburst from Pizza Mind? But regardless, yeah. We're joined by an incredible character, incredible communicator in this space, Austin Federa, who's the head of strategy and communications at the Solana Foundation. So Austin, welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We here at the Crypto 101 podcast love all crypto networks so long as they're legitimate. Not very much bias over here. We love anyone who's trying to move the world forward faster.
We've been let down by fraudsters in the past.
Luna, we have it. No, no negativity. No negativity here, Bryce.
We're going to keep
it positive over here. I'm going to send you the money, and don't you make me do it? Okay, I got to calm down here. All right. Anyway, I saw an amazing stat that despite all the bear market last year, development in the space was up tremendously, like 80%. Developer growth last year, and the largest company leading the way of that developer growth was Solana, I think up like 28% of that 80. So that's phenomenal. You were working over at Solana Labs, who's building Solana Pay and several other of the products over there before a lateral movement, not like a leaving and joining, but a lateral movement over to the foundation, which is doing a lot of the grants and ecosystem support. Can you walk us through, just give us a large overview, State of the Union address of Solana in general, because I think there's a lot of misunderstandings and a lot of fear that's still out there here towards the end of January in 2023 because of what happened a few months ago. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, because I think if you looked at the headlines in November and the second half of November and even starting up to the beginning of December, you know, it was doom and gloom for the Solana ecosystem. But then, you know, the report that you just mentioned is put out by a group called Electric Capital. They're kind of the gold standard of like multi-chain developer reporting, because it's really hard to compare, you know, developers on Ethereum to developers on Cosmos to developers on Solana. And so this group does a really great job of tracking that. The reason we know it's good is every layer one complains about the developer report. So if everyone's upset that like, oh, the report miscounted me, it probably means they're counting everyone about accurate. So, you know, the Electric Capital report showed that Solana is the fastest growing developer ecosystem in blockchain. There's over 2,200 full-time developers working on protocols across the Solana network. And, you know, this period of time covers, I think December 15th is the cutoff date. So this includes the period of time after FTX. And so if there was some massive exodus from the ecosystem, it would have shown up on the report. But what we kind of continue to see is like the fundamentals of the network haven't changed. And so the people who were building on Solana because they thought it was the best place for them to build whatever it was they were trying to build, they're still building here because it's the place that suits them and suits their needs. So I think what we've seen is like a bunch of the community coming back together and galvanizing and forking out the parts of the ecosystem that had FTX involvement. Like Serum was this DeFi protocol that FTX had built. That's been replaced by something called OpenBook, which, you know, the great thing about open source code is you can just take it and redeploy it. So there's a lot of that work being done to sort of, you know, remove the parts of the ecosystem that have been tainted. But at the same time, you know, 90% of the ecosystem had no involvement with FTX at all, and they're continuing to do good, even in the bear market.
So when people think about Solana, what's the first thing that you want them to think of? And you know, our audience is, you know, Crypto 101, right? So yeah. It tends to be, you know, folks that are not super duper deep technical into the weeds, but from a consumer standpoint, right? What are people supposed to associate Solana with?
Yeah, so Solana is built on the thesis that you can build Web3 ecosystems just as performant as Web2 ecosystems. And so that means that it's just as cheap to use as a Web2 service, it's just as performant to use as a Web2 service, but it gives you all of the principles of decentralization and blockchain governance and all those sorts of things that you expect from a decentralized blockchain ecosystem. And so Solana is It's kind of strange to say, but it's a bit of a spiritual cousin to Ethereum. And it's a very different take on how to get to the same goals as Ethereum. But, you know, the mission and alignment is pretty similar there. It's to build an incredibly fast smart contract platform that can handle pretty much whatever the world needs it to handle from an information standpoint, from a market standpoint. You know, this is not relying on sharding or any of those technologies to produce, you know, scale and throughput. It's running in one global state, which I know these things are not exactly the most consumer friendly side of things, but like the idea of one global state is like what made Ethereum what it is today, that you can have all of these relationships between different protocols that from a consumer perspective tear down the walls between things. If I have $20,000 in a bank at Bank of America and I go to Chase and I say, hey, can I get a $10,000 loan? I've got $20,000 in Bank of America. Chase will laugh you out of the room and say, no, go talk to Bank of America. We're not going to deal with you. But with crypto, because different programs in one global state can all establish trust with one another, you can have, you know, staked tokens in one area and you can take out a loan against them using another protocol. And that's really what that whole idea of decentralized finance and atomic transactions in one global state is all about.
And will sharding or the roadmap for Ethereum 2.0 break Ethereum's shared state?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, this is the thing about sharding is you're basically creating parallel copies of the blockchain. And those things all sync up at various checkpoints. And ETH2, I think, was designed somewhere around 20 minutes, or at least it was a few months ago. I haven't checked if they've changed that. But what that means is that, you know, it's sort of like driving on like a 60-lane highway, right? You're all going in the same direction. It's all moving forward. But if you want to get from the outside lane and on one end of the highway to the outside lane on the other end of the highway, there's a lot you have to do to actually move over and switch lanes. That's kind of the best analogy for sharding. Yeah, exactly, right? And so when you're moving between shards on any sharded network, there's a bridge involved, basically, in that process there. And so you can do
lots of bridges on Ethereum, that's for sure.
Yeah, so shards are basically inter-protocol bridges. And so they don't have the same composability. Like, you can technically use a bridge now and do a transaction between, like, let's say Solana and Avalanche, right? But that's not an atomic transaction. That requires two different components involved in it. It involves a bridge in between. When you're moving between shards on a blockchain, it's a very similar process behind the scenes. Now, of course, it's a much smoother experience for the user. But if what we care about is that atomic composability, if we care about this ability for, you know, to not have to worry about what shard you're on, right? It's like I'm trying to use Uniswap in a sharded environment, suddenly liquidity is split between different shards. It becomes less capital efficient. At the same time,
is it the same thing as if there's, you know, miners that are mining two different chains, right? And it's like, of course, the longest chain will be the consensus chain. And so everybody's going to mine that. But sometimes people try and do a deep reorganization attack in Bitcoin where they'll start to mine from kind of deep within the chain, put a ton of power behind that one chain, and then kind of, you know, it's never really been successfully done on Bitcoin. And I think that maybe the postulation is that it could be done on Ethereum once it comes out, because there's so many different, like, it's by design supposed to be gamed that way in a sense.
Well, so the thing is that proof of stake actually is designed to solve a lot of this problem. So in Bitcoin, the beauty of proof of work systems is that they can recover from pretty much any level of failure just by being on long enough, right? So if you saw, like, when China did a big exodus of Bitcoin mining, what was that, a year ago, year and a half ago?
2 years ago,
point?
Almost now.
Yeah, okay. So you saw Bitcoin blocks get like 2 hours long, but the network was able to recover even when a huge amount of the hash power dropped, because the algorithm over time readjusts to wherever the hash power is on the network.
Right.
The downside of that is if you throw a bunch of hash power at the network, you can take control of the network. And that's very unlikely, but it is a risk. And with proof of stake networks, because there's a fixed amount of asset, or at least a known amount of asset, in order to execute an attack on the network, you have to control the actual tokens, as opposed to just controlling the hash power. So there are two different approaches to security. I think, like, you know, a fun thought experiment is, like, if the world actually switched to using Bitcoin as a reserve currency, do we really think that, like, Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and all the defense contractors wouldn't just start manufacturing Bitcoin miners and suddenly the federal government could take control of the Bitcoin network just based on hash power. Like, I think that's a risk people often don't take into account when they're talking about proof of work systems.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's a lot of different kind of ways we could take this conversation. I think, you know, myself included, a lot of people initially when they look at Solana think, oh, it's just another, you know, quote unquote Ethereum killer. It's just trying to be another smart contract platform that's riding the coattails. But in reality, it's not just trying to be another smart contract platform that's doing things faster and cheaper. It's doing it in a completely different way. And I think that's something that I really want viewers to walk away with is that, you know, Solana exists for a reason, and it's to do something, you know, a quantum leap, really, from what Ethereum is doing. And Ethereum exists right now for a reason as well. It's trying to do something. It's got a huge developer base. And so both are valid. Both are, you know, key parts, key technologies that are competing in a sense, but they're also, they have very different views of the world. Like, there's different applications that really want to be built on both.
Yeah, and look, no shade at Ethereum. We would not be here without Ethereum, full stop, right? The invention of smart contracts is a concept, like, huge debt everyone owes to the Ethereum community for all that work. But, you know, if Solana were trying to replace Ethereum or compete with Ethereum, it wouldn't have been built on its own runtime, right? So Solana is not EVM compatible, EVM being the Ethereum virtual machine. Most sort of like fast blockchains, and I'm putting that in quotes, they do a bunch of tricks to try and speed up the Ethereum virtual machine, usually at the expense of security. Mm-hmm. And this is why ETH2 is built very different than other networks that are trying to compete with Ethereum or trying to extend Ethereum or scale Ethereum, whatever term you want to use there, because it is hard to make the EVM go faster and keep the security that Ethereum has brought to it. Mm-hmm. So you see solutions like Layer 2s. Layer 2s are nowhere near as secure as Ethereum until they write those transactions back to the Ethereum network, right? And so there's a whole bunch of like intermediate steps to make Ethereum more performant. What Solana has done is basically thrown all that out and said, we're starting from scratch. We're building a different architecture for how that could work. And we can get into some of the technical details about how that is, but you know, it's kind of one of those things where like every once in a while someone tries to label Solana as like an ETH killer. And it's like, if we're trying to kill ETH, we probably would have had EVM support.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. While you guys are built very different, the user experience is pretty much the same thing. You've got a wallet address. You've got a similar browser plugin wallet. You know, you send funds to the address. Sol is the token that acts like gas on the network, except the transactions go way, way, way faster and way, way, way cheaper. So if you've never used Solana, but you've only used Ethereum, there's pretty much nothing to learn other than the names of the different tools and, you know, marketplaces and things like that. So not much of a learning curve over there for everyone else who's crypto native, which is
really
nice.
For the users, no. For the developers, though,
yeah,
there are differences.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's talk about the people who've built this. Like you mentioned, 2,200 developers from around the world coming together. I had the pleasure of meeting many of you at Solana Breakpoint last year in Lisbon and was just very impressed, not just by the talent and intelligence, which can honestly be found just about anywhere, but the level of professionalism. Like, this wasn't a goofy ETH Denver type situation with all kinds of nonsense going on and, you know, just wildness, but
there were no dance routines and unicorn outfits.
No, there was no decentralized dance party at the or Doge meetups or anything. This was really just a team of professional people that were here to build together quietly, without making a lot of noise, but letting their work speak for them. So I wanted to ask you, what was it like during the toughest time when the FTX thing broke, a lot of funding that, you know, projects were holding were on FTX and were frozen or lost, and Alameda vanishes. And this was really a come to Jesus moment where everyone had to band together. It was one of the largest collapses of support, not just in crypto history, but in all of the US. Yeah, other than people losing their life savings a year before retirement and the Bernie Madoff scandal, this was like the largest, you know, evaporation of capital and support ever. And you guys had to band together and say, we're going to keep this thing going and just put our blinders on and stay heads down and focus working. Can you give us any insight into what those conversations were like, who the leaders were that stepped up and rallied the troops? What was going on behind closed doors in those moments?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, one of the hardest things about that moment is nothing actually fundamentally changed about the Solana network.
As a small business owner or a hiring manager, you know that success in 2023 all depends on the team members that you surround yourself with. And that's exactly why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. Because with LinkedIn Jobs, you can hire qualified candidates more efficiently by matching open roles with people who have the skills, who have the values and the experiences that you desire in order to help you achieve your goals. In fact, we use LinkedIn Jobs to hire quite a few people here at Crypto 101. LinkedIn Jobs helps you quickly attract qualified candidates to your open jobs with targeting tools. They go beyond resume data by using insights from your job post, your company, and their 875 million member profiles to put your post in front of only the most qualified candidates. And LinkedIn Jobs helps you identify the most qualified candidates and connects you with them fast and free. Now, LinkedIn Jobs makes it easy to screen and rate applicants based on your job qualifications. Guys, it does this all on one platform, okay? And 2023 is all about finding the right team member to help you achieve your goals, okay? This is exactly why small businesses have rated LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus leading competitors. Now, LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the qualified candidates that you want to talk to, and it does it a heck of a lot faster than the competition. So you can go ahead and you could post your free job today at linkedin.com/crypto. Again, to post your job for free, go to linkedin.com/crypto. And terms and conditions do apply.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Usually when you see these sort of like ecosystem collapse type events, and you know, we can look at Terra, something along those lines, we can look at Enron, we can look at WorldCom, right? There's usually something rotten at the core there, whether it's technical or whether it's just like, you know, the whole thing's just a house of cards in the case of Enron, right? Where it's like bad accounting practices that were intentionally misleading people got to a place where there was just no value left in that system.
Which was the case with FTX.
Which was the case with FTX and Alameda. Now, I think what's really interesting there is like, from everything I've read, and these are not people I work with closely at all, but like from everything I've read, like it seems like there was a pretty JV management team mm-hmm. there. And I am personally very curious to see if FTX US is actually in fact on an asset balance sheet level solvent, which, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried keeps claiming on his Substack. I think only time will tell on that. But, you know, there is this perception that the Solana ecosystem was very tightly intertwined with FTX. And that came from, you know, some of the early days where... So the FTX team got involved with Solana in summer of 2020, which was about 4 or 5 months after the network had launched. And they came to the network and they basically saw, like, we could build a central limit order book on DeFi on chain here. And a central limit order book is very different than an AMM or you know, one of those market maker systems you see in most of DeFi. An order book is what like the New York Stock Exchange uses and Chicago Mercantile Exchange. It's a much more advanced form of order book management. And the original idea that FTX had was we're going to build this as the DeFi component to our CeFi exchange. And over time, we're actually probably going to shut down the CeFi exchange and see if we can build this all on DeFi. And you know,
and this
that
was called Serum.
This was Serum, yes. And so Serum was real engineering built by real engineers and real smart people. And sudden, you know, sometime maybe 9 months later, a year later, the focus and vision and the place FTX wanted to spend its time had shifted to DC, to regulation, to sort of using their capital and their advantage in Washington to push legislation that was not particularly DeFi friendly.
They changed, and man.
Yeah, I mean, look, and companies go through this, right? Netflix used to be a champion of net neutrality, and they got big enough that they were like, eh, we can just pay the bill of Comcast. We don't actually care about net neutrality anymore.
Yeah.
And so, like, this companies do this, but that got to a point where there wasn't really any work being done between the folks at like Solana Labs and the folks at FTX because there were just very different values about what should happen. No one had any sense that this was, you know, they were building a house of cards there. But like the protocols they were launching after Serum were just technically very boring projects. They didn't have really much to them. Whereas Serum, you know, this was the first time anyone had built a central limit order book on chain. It could do things that no other DeFi protocol could do. And sort of the testament to that is, you know, Serum still exists now as open book. Now that the token's been taken out, all the FTX involvement's been taken out, but the open source project has been adopted by the community and relaunched and continues to be sort of a hallmark of Solana DeFi. But there really was a pretty dramatic change that took place there. And look, you know, the FTX team invested $50 million in Polygon. They invested, like, I think $40 million in Aptos and Sui. They were not all in on Solana. Solana just happened to be the bet that had made them rich.
What interesting background, because, yeah, I think Solana really did get knocked off its block in terms of pricing, a little bit heavier than Ethereum, Bitcoin, or even a lot of the other kind of layer one competitors. And I think a lot of that, like you said, was because of the public's perception of just a lot of the closeness between Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX and Solana. And one of my favorite quotes from Sam was, "I'll buy all the Solana at $3 that you want to sell and then go fuck off." Yes. And it was like this iconic quote on Twitter that he, like, somebody was trolling him, and then Solana went from $3 to $2.50, and he looked like a hero and all that stuff.
Yeah. But
anyhow, it's good to know.
But like, so the thing that happened there, right, where the price goes, you know, the price caters over the course of like a few days. I don't want to sound too defensive of that, because I think if you're a fund manager and your job is to protect capital and you don't really know what's going on and you just sort of see something scary happening and you think that's like SBF and Solana might actually be like pretty intertwined, it is a pretty scary moment in the market. I think this is the same thing about when ETH dropped to $80 or something around those lines, you know, from about $1,200. It's just massive market panic. And that market panic, I think, is unfortunate, but it's also not something you can really fault people for, because we're all irrational humans at the end of the day, when you know, you get that fear in your head about something and you make a bad choice. So I don't think you can really blame people too much for that. But I think the real thing to look at is, you know, Solana has for most days this year in 2023 has had the most on-chain users of any network. It settles more transactions than all other networks on a daily basis. The users are still here and the developers are still here. And I think that's the real, and the developers and users are actually growing. And so those are the real things to look for, where it's like, yes, there is this massive scare. Like, a lot of people were worried. The doom and gloom headlines came. And, you know, I think internally there were a number of us who were, you know, there was one moment particularly where there was about 26 million SOL tokens that were unstaking from validators. Wow. That's like a 3-day process on Solana. It's not like a 30-day process like on some other chains. And we could see the end of the epoch coming. And the question was, like, what happens next?
Are they all going to
dump?
Because
if 28 million SOL of sell pressure hits the market, that could bring the price extremely low. And, you know, it wasn't exactly the price going down mattered. It was the confidence in the network going down that would have mattered. But we got to, you know, but what we saw is, like, this was just a lot of people who were scared. And they were getting ready to sell if everyone else sold. But at the end of the day, like, that moment passed and we did not see a mass exodus. We did not see massive sell pressure. We did not see massive volume on OTC desks or something like that. Look, and that's not stuff we have full visibility into, but basically the community said, okay, we got our bags packed, but we're still here because we still want to see. Like, if we all just hold on together, I think we can get through this together. And that was actually a really strong moment for the community to be like, oh, no, we're bigger than the markets. We're bigger than the FUD. This thing is built for the long term, and we are building here for the long term as well.
Yeah. No, before I toss it over to Pizza Mind for a question, I just want to say that this is a perfect example of something that I always say. And price is what you pay, but value is what you get. And we're not actually trading assets. You're trading people's perception of assets. And so with Solana, it's a perfect example where, like you said, nothing fundamentally changed. There's more builders. There's more long-term growth. There's more applications. So the fundamentals of that asset did not change, but the price changed, right? Because the perception about the asset changed. And now once all that perception is now cleared up and we're like, oh, clearly they're completely separate and there's not going to be that much overhang, yada, 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 then the price bounces back up. But the people who really made a lot of money on this were the people who were buying Solana when it went down to $4 or whatever, because they said nothing actually changed about this asset. Just people got scared. And you buy the fear and you kind of sell it back to them when they feel comfortable. But anyhow, that's kind of not a question, but something that I just wanted to add here.
That's a great addition because it leads into my question. And that's, where is the value in Solana being built? And I asked that question because this is probably the first podcast a lot of people are hearing about Solana. In Ethereum, they know what Uniswap is. Most people know about, you know, other different things of where to go and find to do whatever they want to do on Ethereum. Without trying to shill or anything, but just as a matter of being informative, like we are on this podcast, can you give a shout out to some of the value creating projects on Solana that people should check out, whether it's an NFT marketplace or a DeFi exchange or whatever, you know, is really, really big on there? What should we look for to get our feet wet?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, one of the best things about Solana is you can set aside 25 cents of token for gas fees, and you can do hundreds of transactions with that amount of money. And that, what that means is the network's really fun and easy to play around with and figure out what you're doing. You don't have to worry about like, oh man, I've done 10 transactions. Like that cost me like 10 or 15 bucks, right? You can really just play around with lots of different types of things. So, you know, Solana, I would say from an NFT perspective, there's a few huge NFT marketplaces. There's Magic Eden, there's Hypersphere, there's Exchange Art, which is like for one of one pieces of art. And one of the cool things you'll see is like the NFT landscape on Solana is very different than it is on Ethereum. There's profile picture projects, of course, like there is everywhere, but a lot of the time there's additional functionality to these things because the cost of transactions are so low. So there's stuff like staking, which is kind of boring, but you know, there's this whole thing called Boots, where basically your NFTs can, it's like, I always joke they should have called it Mr. Potato Head. But it's basically you can like take items and put them on and off of your different NFTs. And so people
What is it called again? Beast?
Boots.
Oh, Boots.
Yes.
Okay.
Why it's called Boots, I don't know. We didn't build the thing. It was built by a whole different team and stuff like that in the community. But the idea is like you can have your NFT and you can, you know, you can buy a Santa hat for it for Christmas. You can buy like a Halloween costume. And like these things are silly and fun, but like they're just little ways to kind of like personalize something that you have even more than that. And on one level, it's like, oh yes, that's a toy, that's a game. On the other hand, like in 5 years, that could be Fortnite. Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing to think about is like a lot of the primitives that you can take and you can look forward, you can say, in a more evolved state of this technology, this could be the way that people outfit their characters in a decentralized gaming ecosystem. This is like different portability, the same way that Fortnite has brought in all this different IP from all these different games that you can then all use within this one sort of game platform. I think on the NFT side of things on Solana, I think that's where stuff gets really exciting for me personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can talk about DeFi too and a bunch of that stuff, but fundamentally it's like, it's a fun place to try stuff out.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And you know, I was one of the naysayers kind of NFTs early on, cause I was such an early DeFi and kind of crypto guy. So I saw the NFTs and I was like, well, like, you know, I played RuneScape, so I remember, you know, the blue party hats that had no statistical value and they were worth the most, right? Or you had, you know, all these different items that, like, they had Santa hats. They were rare, yeah. They were one of a kind, and they were worth, $1 billion, but they had no value, like a new sword or anything. So I was like, okay, well, from that standpoint, you could have digital art or digital pieces of history, essentially, and you could be the owners of that, and that would make a lot of money. And so there's lots of fun little things like that going on in Solana, but there's also really technical breakthroughs. And I remember listening to one of Anatoly's who's the co-founder of Solana, one of his early kind of podcasts talking about, I think it was called Proof of History, which is the unique kind of consensus mechanism that you guys leverage, I believe. And there's also something new that's being built called Fire Dancer. And I hear a lot of buzz about Fire Dancer from really smart people, but to be honest, I don't really have any idea what it is. So could you walk us through those two really, you know, they're kind of technical stuff. Maybe we're going to do a high level overview.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say is proof of history is not actually a consensus mechanism. It still runs on Nakamoto consensus and still runs on proof of stake in terms of its Sybil resistance.
Okay.
The proof of history component is, you can think of it like putting a turbocharger on an existing consensus mechanism. So what happens with proof of history, let's use Ethereum as an example. So on Ethereum, there's a mempool, and a mempool is a giant pool where people submit transactions to, and they say there's a certain amount I want to pay for a gas fee, and the validators get to pick what transactions are coming out of that. What that means is you never actually know exactly when your transaction is going to process. It's up to the validator to basically say, yes, I'd like to accept this transaction, or no, I would like to reject this transaction, right? So what proof of history does is it actually, in a decentralized way through something called a verifiable delay function, but basically it timestamps every transaction that comes into the network. And so because every validator is running on the same distributed clock, when that transaction comes in, you can include it in a block and you can know exactly where it fits in the block. And every validator in the network will have that transaction in the exact same spot in the block. In an ideal situation. What this means is that the transactions can basically not have to be confirmed by the whole network agreeing that this actually did happen, like happens on Ethereum. If you sent an Ether or something like that to an exchange, you'll notice there's like Binance requires you to wait 32 blocks until we actually credit you or some number of blocks. And that's because of the possibility of a double spend. Solana doesn't really have a possibility of double spend in that same way. And so proof of history allows the network to continually produce blocks as opposed to on other blockchains where there's a few seconds of pause between each block production to basically give the network time to catch up. So this means that Solana's performance is much more like a Web2 service where you can just stream data in and out of the thing. So that's the difference with proof of history. I know that's a little bit of a technical answer, but I think it's important to understand how it actually speeds up the network, because most tricks to speed things up compromise on decentralization. And proof of history is actually only works if decentralization exists.
Okay, so before we move on to Fire Dancer, I think that's awesome. Give us a little bit of context around what goes on, because Solana's gone down several times.
Yeah.
You know, if you use certain wallet providers, they're like, hey, don't use Solana. You know, we'll get messages from Coinbase, don't use it. So a lot of our listeners, they'll tag us and be like, hey, like, what's going on with Solana? Is it broken? Totally. Are my transactions reversed? Can you give us some insight into what happens when Solana goes down and why that's happening?
Yeah, so this this was something that we first saw in sort of September of 2021. And really, these were all effects of massive demand for the network, stress testing components of the network that just hadn't been stress tested that high before. Every time you have like an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude increase in traffic, certain pieces will break that you don't necessarily think are going to break. And so, you know, you can call this a curse of success in some ways, that, you know, we got to a place with the network where the uses of the network and the demand for the network actually was higher than the network could supply for a time being there. And this was really, a lot of this came down to what got labeled spam attacks or denial of service attacks, which wasn't really technically accurate. But basically, on Ethereum, you can pay your way to the front of the queue. If you really want to make sure an arbitrage opportunity executes or someone mislists a Bored Ape for 20 ETH instead of 200 ETH, you might pay 2 ETH to make sure your transaction gets to the front of the line so you can capture all that economic opportunity. Back then, and even like in the spring of 2022, Solana didn't have a way for people who were trying to do those types of transactions to pay to get to the front of the line. They attempted to land a transaction by sending the same thing like 10,000 times in 1 second. because they were like, one of these transactions has to land. If I can just basically flood the zone, my chances of getting this arbitrage opportunity are higher. So this is where the idea of local fee markets come in. And local fee markets are similar to what happens on Ethereum with gas fees, except on Ethereum, transactions are scarce and they're expensive. On Solana, they're abundant and they're cheap. So what happens is, let's say you and I are trying to mint the same NFT, and we want the exact same one. Now, the one of us that pays the higher fee will get it nowadays. But that won't actually have any impact on Pizza's ability to like send a Solana transfer. And so this is like the thing. If you remember the time when like the Bored Ape Yacht Club did their ape coin drop and people were spending like $3,500 on gas fees just to grab that airdrop. On Solana, the gas fees for the airdrop may have spiked, but that would have had no impact on the rest of the network. Like Chainlink wasn't sending Oracle updates because the gas fees were so high for a period of time, right? All those types of, like, this had massive impact on bridges, on rollups, and all these sorts of things. With local fee markets on Solana, the impact of price is isolated to just the area where that spike is occurring, which is pretty cool.
Wow, that's incredible, and a much necessary innovation, really, for any blockchain network. So, Austin, we can't thank you enough for spending the last 35 minutes with us, smartening us up, giving us clarity. Clarity is a big word, especially for me going forward. We just have one more question for you before we let you get back to building the future. What's one company that's building on Solana or supporting Solana who's going to have the greatest impact going forward? Whether it's a venture capital group, market maker, a developer lab, or even just a product that a lot of people are collaborating on. What's the one thing we need to watch out for in 2023 and beyond?
So I think the thing behind the scenes is FireDancer. So FireDancer is getting built by Jump Trading, which is a high-frequency trading firm. But they're building a new validator client for Solana. And Solana is going to become the second network. Ethereum is the only other network with more than one validator client. And having multiple...
I did not know that.
yeah. It's Ethereum, Bitcoin, and Solana are the only ones with multiple validator client implementations. But Bitcoin's obviously not a smart contract network, so it's a little bit different there. But the power of this thing is a fewfold. First, it's going to enable greater resiliency of the network because you have two different copies of the implementation. So the chance of there being a bug in the same location on both pieces of code is extremely low. The second piece is they're able to sort of start from scratch. And by starting from scratch and knowing the state of Solana today, you can actually build a system that's much more optimized and performant. So a lot of the learnings they're coming to about how to build something as efficiently as possible can actually be brought into the existing validator client as well. And so we're hoping that work will see dramatic increases in performance on the network. In testing environments, they've pushed 1.2 million transactions per second through it. Now, I want to be clear, I don't think we're going to see 1.2 million transactions per second actually on mainnet. But this is like the upper theoretical bounds of what's possible, and that's about 10 times faster than the current theoretical bounds of what you see on the existing client. So that's kind of a back-end thing, but I think there's going to be I think you're going to see developers being able to build even more stuff on Solana you can't build elsewhere because the performance of the network is going to scale to that point.
Awesome. Well, man, Austin, there's so much more that we want to dive into. And there's just a million different ways we can go, but unfortunately we're hitting time. Yes. And you got a lot to do, so we want to let you go. But without further ado, Austin, where's the best place we could point to our users so that they could learn more?
So I would say for developers, there's a Solana developers Twitter account. That's a really great one to check out, or solana.com/developers. If you want to learn more about the network in general, check out just like solana.com, tons of info there, whole ecosystem project directory and that sort of thing. Too. I will say also the Electric Capital Report, which we mentioned at the top of the episode today, is definitely worth a read. They give a really great profile of what's happening, not just on Solana, but the state of development across the entire ecosystem.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Austin, for that. We look forward to reconnecting again in the near future. Take care.
Thanks for having me.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.